Hello, welcome, and happy Halloween. This is the Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. And my name is Kurt Holman, and I'm a writer for Creative Loafing in Atlanta. And with me are my usual co-hosts.
I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com.
And it's October 29th, and none of us actually have seen Saw 7 3D and aren't very, really inclined to see it. Although I will say that it seems like the kind of movie that 3D is really made for, you know, just like Jackass 3D and Saw 3D and, you know, this not messed up good movies, you know, basically. But this is the weekend that The Walking Dead premieres on American Movie Classics with its 90-minute pilot episode, which all of us have seen, and the second episode. So I figured that instead we would talk about The Walking Dead and maybe about the zombie genre in general and why it's so popular and seems like it's always like it should have peaked by now and gone away and doesn't seem to go away. And one can make zombie, it hasn't been shot in the head yet kind of jokes, you know. But let's like kind of talk zombies this week. And do one of y'all want to talk about The Walking Dead, how it starts, or shall I?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Walking Dead is based on a comic book, which I've not read, mm-hmm. so I can't discuss how it works mm-hmm. as an adaptation of that comic. Though in discussions with other people who do know the comic much better and have also seen the first couple episodes, mm-hmm. they do say it's very faithful. Mm-hmm. But the basic idea begins with a sheriff's deputy from small town Georgia, a guy named Rick Grimes, mm-hmm. and he's wounded in the line of duty and is in the hospital recovering from a gunshot wound and sort of wakes up. And it's not unlike the opening of 28 Days Later, mm-hmm. where he wakes up in the hospital and realizes that things are very wrong because there's no one around. The flowers that he'd been given have obviously been dead for some time. Yeah. And it turns out that there was some sort of zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, while you were sleeping.
Exactly. While you were away. Uh-huh. Oops. So it's also kind of the same opening from Day of the Triffids mm-hmm. from years ago.
I guess
ago.
So. I had not thought about it.
And that opening supposedly inspired 28 Days Later, and now we see that once more in The Walking Dead, but it works quite well. Mm-hmm. And so Rick kind of leaves the hospital. He's very confused, and he makes his way home, and he discovers that things have gone very, very bad in the world mm-hmm. outside, and quite a lot of people are dead. Quite a lot of those who've died have come back to life and are walking around and trying to eat the people who've not yet died at all. Mm. And humanity, as it tends to do in these sort of fictional setups at the very least, has sort of fragmented and self-destructed, and most aspects of it. The aspects that we've seen so far seem to be trying to pull together into some sort of semblance of society, mm-hmm. but
the social order has basically fallen.
It's gone, and that's kind of a big thematic point in the series, mm-hmm. or it seems as if it might be, because there's a. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, in the second episode, there's a guy who sort of is emblematic of the old kind of divided, racist, mm-hmm. you know, jerk-off sort of stereotype character from some of these horror movies. Mm-hmm. And in an interaction with him, Rick, the main character, says, you know, there's no more of this stuff mm-hmm. anymore. There's just living and dead. You know, mm-hmm. that's all there is. So yeah, I mean, the shows so far, the first two episodes have a pretty good combination of sort of horror / thriller mm-hmm. set pieces, plus a lot of character stuff going on, mm-hmm. and there are kind of two parallel stories where you see Rick trying to find his wife and child who are gone, and mm-hmm. he has faith that they're alive, but he doesn't know that they are, and then we see this sort of small survivors camp, which is mm-hmm. somewhere outside of Atlanta, mm-hmm. and there's sort of vague, almost communication between Rick and the camp, and you can see that eventually things are going to come together and that it'll right. build to some sort of a head.
And the camp is where his wife and daughter, wife and child, not his wife and son.
Yeah, right. Wife and son.
Sorry about
right.
that. And also his former partner is on the force is as well. So he knows people in the camp, but it's not.
He doesn't know that he knows people in the camp.
He doesn't know he knows people in the camp, and they don't know that he's out there, even though. You know, one of the things I like about it is, you know, when you watch horror I think maybe for a lot of movies, there's always that implication. It's like, why don't you do this? Mm-hmm. And The Walking Dead actually does say, like, oh, that is a sensible move. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, Rick puts on an emergency channel mm-hmm. and broadcasts as if anyone's out there. But for one reason or another, they can hear him or they can't hear him.
Well, I mean, it's like he's broadcasting over a distance, you know, with sort of limited band radios. And plus, at a certain point, there's a storm that's hitting, and that's mm-hmm. obviously causing problems. So there are just enough logistical problems and technical difficulties to keep them apart.
Exactly. Hopefully it won't be like Sun and Jin in the last season or two seasons of Lost where, you know, they're up. Oh, you just missed them, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
I've actually read, I guess, the first 8 or 9 of kind of the collections of The Walking Dead. Mm. And it's written by a man named Robert Kirkman, and he's had two artists who have worked on it, you know, during his tenure on it. And one of his, like, approaches to The Walking Dead as a graphic novel would be to be like a zombie movie without an ending, you know, because in the movies, right. either, you know, they end, it looks like they'll be happy, or everyone dies, you know. And this one is like, you know, well, if you have this kind of situation, it's just going to go on, and
right.
life will just continue. So what happens when you're in this zombie apocalypse and it's open-ended and there may be no salvation?
Right.
And how, you know, do the people, like, change under this horrible pressure? And how do they sort of, like, how do things become just sort of normal and every day? And it's like, oh, I got to go out and, like, there's some zombies around, so I have to kill them and then, you know, find canned goods and stuff
right.
like that, you know. And it's really interesting how in the comic how it unfolds over time and how they go to different places and mm-hmm. have these different things. And bad stuff happens, I won't say very frequently, but it goes to some really bad places in that. Like, no main character is safe in it, you know, so
right.
so it's like, I have to kind of like spend some time away from it for a while because, like, oh, that was a kick where it hurts and need to sort of read something lighter for a while, you know.
And I kind of like that. I mean, the sense I get in the first two episodes is that this will be kind of a sort of episodic storytelling mm-hmm. in that characters are going to come in and out, and you've obviously got Rick Grimes and then this camp of people, mm-hmm. but then you get the sense that there are going to be quite a few other characters who sort of drift in and out of the thing, and maybe you'll see them again, mm-hmm. maybe you won't, maybe you'll get some resolution to them. I mean, there are two characters introduced in the first episode that, you know, that sort of go their own way at the end of that episode, mm-hmm. and you're like, well, okay, maybe they're going to live, maybe they're going to die, you don't know. And I kind of like that because, like you're saying, it sort of seems appropriate to this sense
of... It makes it feel like a bigger story and that there are all these people. And sort of if you were to follow every single character, sometimes that makes a world seem smaller. It's like the only people that are in the world are the ones we're following in this story. And when you have people that flit in and out, it makes the world seem larger.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also the storytelling here is pretty low key, mm-hmm. you know, and the series was developed and produced by Frank Darabont, the guy who did Shawshank Redemption mm-hmm. and The Mist, and he directed the opening episode, and you know it doesn't look like a movie. I mean, it definitely mm-hmm. looks like TV, although it's TV with very high production value, especially mm-hmm. when it comes to effects and the zombie makeup and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But his storytelling is, and what's established so far, is really pretty kind of quiet, mm-hmm. and the pacing is a little bit weird, mm-hmm. which I like. You know, it's not as predictable mm-hmm. as the beats are often paced in zombie movies as we've seen them in mm-hmm. general, and like the use of music is pretty minimal, mm-hmm. and the music that's in it I like quite a bit, but it's not used to kind of like amp up these big scare moments mm-hmm. or whatever, and I like that. It makes it feel like a good kind of the world is dead outside
sort of
scenario.
To compare it to, say, True Blood, or the episodes that I've seen of that, which is totally lurid
right.
and Southern Gothic and, you know, way kind of over the top. And this one, it's frequently kind of deadpan, and there's a pale look about it, mm-hmm. and it'll, like, use, like, not much dialogue and silence to kind of build tension in parts.
Right.
And it's interesting how that kind of fits with stuff like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and, I guess, Rubicon, although I've only watched the pilot of Rubicon, which apparently Mad Men and Rubicon are very kind of deadpan, quiet, low-key dramas. You know, Breaking Bad can be deadpan, and it can go like way into crazy violence territory too. And I think part of the reason I know a lot of people have been like really excited about The Walking Dead, both people I know face to face and like on blogs and things like that. And I think the idea is like, you know, well, zombies are cool and I don't really see zombie movies that much, but if AMC's doing it, think how cool that might be, you know.
Right.
So,
well, I think the part of it is that zombies aren't really cool anymore.
Yeah.
They're still around, and I think there's a certain audience, even the audience for something like this is sort of like, why are we still seeing all these zombie movies, you know? Because at a certain point, there's only so much you can do with it unless you're really smart and really forward-thinking. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been a lot of that. And I think The Walking Dead seems like this promise of, oh, wow, okay, it's Frank Darabont, who's one of the only people to ever do a good Stephen King adaptation, and who's made genuinely entertaining films in his own right, you know. So it's him, and it's AMC, and it's this comic that people generally quite like, and all of those things together. So, hey, wow, maybe this one will be the exception.
And that's what draws me in, because I'm not, like, for me, there are some people, like, they just love zombie stuff. Like, I'm not one of those people that would ever buy the zombie survival guide. Like,
oh, yeah.
Some people think that's like hilarious, and it's like, I love zombies, and or like Marvel did this offshoot where they turn their characters into zombies, and I'm like, creatively called Marvel Zombies, and to me, it's like, I don't really get the appeal. It's like, okay, now you've taken something, and now it looks, it's shambling and dead and wants to eat you. Okay, now, I mean, back when, you know, you get George Romero doing this, and you have like a cool social subtext, I'm like, oh, okay,
sure.
The zombies have weight. They have their, you know, symbolic.
Right.
But now it's the idea of like the zombie is cool. I've never really bought into that. What I buy in more into is just, is this a really well-made property?
Sure.
And can you use zombies as an interesting storytelling device? Mm-hmm. I don't like Zombieland because it's full of zombies. I like Zombieland because it's funny and just very quick-witted. If it were just like, we're just going to kill us a bunch of zombies, which essentially is the premise of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a huge narrative push. It's just, we're going to kill zombies for 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Let's do it in a really fun way.
Yeah.
And they do. So with The Walking Dead, I think the zombie effects are done incredibly well, but what drew me in is that it seems to be, we're going to focus on characters and we're just going to have strong production values and strong storytelling, and there happen to be zombies.
Yeah. Right. One thing about it is that, you know, it at heart, the premise is your basic zombie apocalypse, you know? I mean, it's almost like this weirdly elaborate cliche that's almost like this open source story where it's like everyone can just go in and do the story that's basically exactly like the original Night of the Living Dead story,
right?
You know, like Shaun of the Dead does and Zombieland does.
Yeah.
It's funny how it's just sort of taken as a given, you know, and in the first two episodes, no one sort of says, like, you know, well, goes into like why zombies have.
They don't even
and
say the word zombie.
Yeah. That's probably
Shaun of the Walkers, Dead. Or geeks,
which is wonderful. I don't know if you know, and I'm sure not using the word zombie is like one of the rules if you're to do this, you know.
Yeah.
But and I don't know if like it will they'll actually say why the zombie apocalypse happened. I don't know if they ever do in the comic book. I know that they're and it's very faithful to the comic book, but it kind of expands on certain scenes and ideas. Mm-hmm. I believe there are episodes coming up that take place at the CDC, and I don't remember those being in the comic, but it's in Atlanta. It makes perfect sense. That's where else would you go with
exactly?
You know, but one thing but kind of bugs me about
also a Stephen King thing. CDC was a big part of
The Stand. Yeah. It's kind of like Frank Darabont doing The Stand
in a way.
It is like to kind of like just another zombie story. So it's like, well, great, but it's like I think about Dexter, the Showtime show, where it's like this is a totally original, within reason, take on a serial killer who's, you know, on the show is like, you know, socially perfectly functional and yet murders people with these real complicated ethical reasons, you know. So it's like it's not a great show, but Michael C. Hall is really great on it. And
right.
the character is like, I've never seen anything like this. And Walking Dead is like, you know, well, I have seen this,
right.
you know.
So. But I haven't seen it on television done in episodic form. Mm-hmm. And I think it sort of comes yeah. back to what the comic is, mm-hmm. is it's trying to take it long form. And so you're going to get into the show and it's like, yeah, this is like a zombie movie. But I'm thinking if you give it time, mm-hmm. and it's like, wow, well, no zombie movie has really gone on this long with this mm-hmm. many characters right. to just keep going. I mean, obviously you have, you know, zombie franchises, but rarely do you have, you know, a same core group of characters mm-hmm. moving through the same
right.
world.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I think that you're asking earlier, too, about the pervasive or just the fact that zombies keep going. Mm-hmm. And some of it is, I think, that done well, mm-hmm. the zombie film is kind of – it's very analogous to the Western in a way, you know, because it's like it's a way, okay, how can we take modern America but make it a frontier mm-hmm. again? You know, how can we take modern America but remove – a great deal of the established social conditions and kind of put it back to a scenario where people are building society once again. And that's one of the big things in the Western is, you know, the frontier and the idea that you've always got kind of this clash between the fiercely independent guy who has gone to the frontier to live that. And then there's, you know, this is always a thing in the John Ford films and other Westerns from the 30s to the 50s is you've got the woman who represents the East and civilization and they come together and, you know, how does that work? And there are similar impulses and similar things at work in zombie movies, mm-hmm. theoretically at the very least. And you can already see them in The Walking Dead just with the idea of the way that society is trying to be put back together.
Sure, and the way Rick Grimes carries himself is very
old-fashioned.
I mean, they put him on a horse
exactly.
in the first episode. He's a cowboy on a horse. Yeah. So it's like it's not like this is any sort of rocket science to draw this parallel.
He's a sheriff's right. deputy even with a star on
exactly.
his thing. Did you make all this up, by the way? Because that's a great comparison between zombie movies and Westerns.
Yeah,
that's ingenious in a way.
So. It's something that we've seen before, but mm-hmm. I think The Walking Dead makes it very explicit. Mm-hmm. And I'm really – again, not having the comic, not having read the comic, so not knowing where it's going to go, I'm really curious to see how that's developed and where those themes and those core ideas are taken. Mm-hmm. But it really seems like that's where this is going. And for me, as someone who loves Western and mm-hmm. Westerns in general, I mean, that's a really beautiful marriage of mm-hmm. like taking horror and, you know, making a decent kind of horror-themed Western or Western-themed horror. Mm-hmm. It's like, fantastic.
Did you get the Red Dead Redemption pack?
They just sent me a code for it, so I will play it this evening. And actually, that's something in which I have no interest. That's where I was like, you know, Red Dead Redemption being the very popular Western video game from the people who made Grand Theft Auto. They've this week they've just released an undead like zombie expansion pack where for whatever reason in the game you can now fight zombies. So I'm kind of like, okay, sure, fine. The game was fun in the first place. Maybe it'll still be fun. But
is The Walking Dead at one level might seem like, you know, well, this will be the culmination of the zombie films and it can go away. But there's talk about doing this big movie called World War Z based on a novel by Max Brooks, who happens to be the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. And the book is, you know, you're a basic zombie apocalypse again, you know, and it's told by all these different people, you know, from these different points of view in America and the world and about like sort of what happens. And at first it's like, yeah, so the usual. But it has some really inventive and imaginative perspectives on like, well, what do you do if there's a zombie apocalypse and you're on a space station or if you're in a submarine and where you go.
Max Brooks also wrote How to Survive a Zombie Apocalypse.
Yeah,
he wrote that as well. So
okay.
It's definitely in his bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. So,
but it's funny you mentioned like one, you know, that is a zombie movie mm-hmm. because one of the hottest properties right now in Hollywood is the adaptation of Pride and Prejudice and zombies, mm-hmm. which is, again, is another one of those things. It's like you just threw zombies in there.
Yeah,
and you must really like zombies mm-hmm. to throw it in there.
Yeah.
Well, and the great thing about Pride and Prejudice and zombies, or I'm not – maybe the great thing is the wrong term. The amusing thing about mm-hmm. it is that the guy – I mean, Pride and Prejudice is public domain, mm-hmm. and the guy who wrote Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, I think kept like 85% of the original text of Pride and Prejudice, and then took 15% and changed it and added zombies. And
now he's a best-selling author.
Replace Mr. Darcy with undead Mr. Darcy.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's like, to a certain extent, I'm irritated with it because I'm like, why the Christ did I not think of this? Yeah. Why didn't I do this? Mm-hmm. Because it just seems so easy, you know, and suddenly this guy's rolling in cash and I'm not. You know, he got to it first.
Mm-hmm. But then again, when you pitch it as a movie, like it couldn't, it's like I've heard Victorian era Zombieland. Okay. But it's sort of like when you reach that point, it's like maybe we have run out of things for the zombie movie.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and that The Walking Dead can at least establish itself by being that long form story that you can't get in a movie theater.
Yeah, I think that currently there was talk about Natalie Portman being in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
She's out.
And now is out because David O. Russell was going to do it, but he went out.
Right.
So it's like it seemed like it was going to happen, and now it's kind of in the nether zone where they don't know.
I mean, I think that's we keep hearing that they're looking for a director, and I mean, David O. Russell wrote the script, and last we've heard that script is still being used, which is just kind of a total mind-blowing thing to me in the first place, a David O. Russell scripted.
I'm stuck on him for Uncharted. I still can't get over
it. That either. It's like Spank the Monkey, I Heart Huckabees.
And now a zombie movie and a video game movie.
It's like Darren Aronofsky in the Wolverine movie.
That I get. That I can actually understand because to me that seems more like a one for them, one for me deal.
Sure, and it's him working with Hugh Jackman again.
Exactly.
And all that. But still, I mean, there's a lot of commentary to be made about where studio development is gone and the fact that you've got these big directors who are big in a creative sense and in a sense of having influence and being interesting, and there seem to be sort of scrambling for these weird, not terribly interesting genre projects like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And maybe you put somebody really creative on it and maybe they do something that's at least fun and okay, sure, but would I rather see Darren Aronofsky writing and directing his own little weird crazy movies like Black Swan and The Wrestler and anything else? Yes, absolutely. I don't know. Weirds me out. It bugs me.
Back to The Walking Dead, one of the things I did want to talk about is sort of how, and speaking of, you know, directors who have been able to make a name for themselves, is Darabont. Is how I do like that it still comes back under all of his material seems to always fall back under this general theme of exploring hope and despair. And you still get that. And in some ways, I felt like this is sort of in the same world as The Mist, where it's like that horror world gone to hell. It's like, who's going to off themselves?
Right.
Who's, like, we're just countdown to suicide town in Atlanta. Just who's going to murder themselves on Darabont's watch? But I mean, one of the things I like about that, though, is I think he explores those themes in an intelligent way and not just sort of in a, you know, oh, everything will be fine. Give us a hug.
Right.
I'll say one of my criticisms of the pilot episode is that there's a scene that happens before zombie apocalypse happens, and Rick and his partner Shane are kind of chatting in their squad car and eating lunch, and they're talking about kind of the difference between men and women, and they talk about like little kind of quotidian things that will become utterly trivial once the zombie apocalypse happens, and also kind of like important emotional things that will become very important, you know, and which one knows from kind of your omniscient audience point of view. But the dialogue was real kind of fake folksy in that Stephen King way, when Stephen King tries to sound fake folksy. And it felt a lot like, since Darabont's adapted so many Stephen King stuff, that those instincts might be rubbed off on him. It didn't appear that much in the rest of the shows we've seen so far. So a little bit more in the second, particularly with a character played by Michael Rooker. But it's like, I'm kind of like, I hope it doesn't go to that level too much, you know.
Yeah.
And another point I think is worth making is that this isn't really a criticism per se. But it's like, people might think like, well, it's on basic cable, so how gory can it be, you know? And the idea is like, it's really
pretty
goddamn gory.
Until only gets a TV-14.
Yeah.
Can't get a TVM, apparently, matter what you
do
regarding gore.
I mean, there's a scene in the second episode where it's like, okay, well, they're having this gory thing, and it's like, and I'm sure they'll cut away any minute. And it's like, nope.
They just not keep cutting.
We just keep seeing more and more, and, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's a lot of – I think there were more – really entrails consumed there than there could have possibly been in the thing that was being consumed. Yeah,
come on, there's only 4 quarts of blood in a body. Yeah, I can't believe that this
exactly.
is...
Exactly. It's like a Dungeons & Dragons bag of holding full of... Where are they all coming from? Yeah.
So, but it's like...
that was the nerdiest thing I've said on
Yeah, I wasn't going to say. But it's like the Mad Men fans... may not stick around, you know, for the long haul if, you know, if they're pretty squeamish, you know.
Basically. Yeah, it's relatively as a piece of horror, it's mm-hmm. pretty satisfying in that respect. And because it's maybe a little touch of gore for gore's sake, mm-hmm. which I'm fine with. A lot of other people aren't. I love it. Mm-hmm. Most of the violence is pretty well motivated and actually has some kind of good impact. You know, it's like when the whole event that is around mm-hmm. that one big gory bit that you're talking mm-hmm. about, it's like when that starts to go down, you're like, oh man, you're really screwed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's like it's effective and it works in more than just sort of the prurient sense mm-hmm. of being like, ah, here's a bunch of blood and guts.
Yeah.
One of the things I liked is that there does seem they want to remind viewers that there is a cost. Mm-hmm. That it's, again, coming back to like why the zombie, you know, genre is popular. I think there is this popular notion of I want to kill people, but not really.
Right.
I want to hunt humans, but not really
that's
hunt humans.
I think that's a great
and
example,
so
too.
This has to remind people, like, okay, this is happened. Like, these people have names, and if you're going to take a life, you know, that life may already be gone, but it's not that easy to always just pull the trigger and, like, take someone who looks human. I mean, they're dead and kind of gross, but there was a person there, and you can't just, you know, flip a switch like, okay, there's zombies now. Kill, kill, kill. I'm totally cool with it.
Yeah.
And in both episodes, each episode that we've seen so far has a sequence that really, really gets at that. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a really touching one in the first episode where that whole idea of like, yeah, it's not a person, but it was.
Yeah,
and there's a lot attached to that. Mm. And then in the second episode, there's a good little sequence that kind of had me chanting his name was Robert Paulson from Fight Club in my head. Is that, like, this group of people is trying to basically do something with the zombie, like put it to use.
Yeah.
And Rick is sort of like,
they take the character's wallet and say, this person had a name and we should respect
the name.
He died
with $28 in his wallet and blah, blah, blah. And
before we
who he was.
Get into this horrible thing we're about to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Out of necessity.
And it is horrible. Mm-hmm. And it's, that little emotional bump before that works really well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, despite the Fight Club jokes.
But I love the idea that, like, shooting zombies is like a surrogate for just shooting real people, what you said, because I think there's a little to that. And it reminds me of, like, there's a meme where you, like, that would go around with, like, asking people like a little poll. It's like, if you were like basically in the shopping mall of Dawn of the Dead and you could shoot all the zombies, like, what would your weapon be?
Right.
What music would be playing on the PA? And which celebrity would you have with you doing that? You know, and people could do their little picks and all mm-hmm. that, you know. So there's something, I mean, and it might be kind of a video game quality too of like this.
Oh, sure.
You know,
Well, I mean, there's certainly almost even more so in. In video games now than in movies, there's this whole kind of wave of weird zombiness, you know, to the point where games that have nothing to do with zombies will have a bonus unlockable mode where, you know, it's
or
like
downloadable content like Red Dead Redemption, Undead Nightmare.
Available now. You know, Call of Duty, you know, one of the giant war game. It's like, oh, hey, here's a mode where instead of fighting Nazis, you're fighting zombie Nazis. That's awesome. And it's, you know, people love that. And there is that whole sort of, hey, they're not, they look like people, but they're not.
But I would feel really guilty if I killed people. Now I don't feel as guilty.
Exactly.
In fact, I feel encouraged. I'm doing my part.
Yeah.
It's an inconsequential killing spree.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah. So.
I mean, we haven't really, I don't know, maybe it's been in a movie and I've missed it, but there hasn't. I don't remember seeing the scene where the lone survivor of the zombie apocalypse wakes up and he's wandering around, and then he realizes what happened, and he goes to where he used to work to try to find his boss. You know, and it's like, finally, I can put a bullet in the head of that son of a bitch that I've hated for years. Yeah. You know, so.
And conversely, I don't think there's ever been a scene where it's like someone goes through all the hell of, you know, shooting the loved ones and kill me because I'm bitten, you know. And then it's like, oh, we discovered a cure and we could have brought all those people back to life. You know,
that's kind of the Frank Darabont.
Yeah. I was about to say, I saw the mist.
Yeah.
Pretty much. We should also address the fact that some of The Walking Dead was shot in Atlanta and around Atlanta, and there's some of the location stuff I really appreciated, just for the, you know, the opening where Rick Grimes is in whatever town he lives in, which is not named, somewhere up 85.
Kentucky, I believe, is where it's supposed to be. You know. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, but he's. I mean, it's.
I thought he was in Macon.
He's clearly in Georgia, and I think he's a Georgia. Like maybe in the comic he was Kentucky, but
yeah,
it seems in the. Even in the show, it seems like he's pretty clearly in Georgia. It certainly looks like Georgia because it's like looks like every house I've ever lived in as long as I've been here. But it's nice to see, you know, this stuff shot on location. And, you know, there's a point where he makes his way back to his house and he's sort of freaking out and trying to figure out if this is actually reality. And, like, the hardwood floor has all kind of the, you know, the scuffs and scrapes that, you know, an old – you know, a house in Georgia would obviously have and that would be in a house where people have kids, you know, and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of stuff like that that really works. And then at the same time, when suddenly in the second episode you see a bus that's clearly a prop bus that was supposed to be a New York City metro bus.
Metro local bus.
Come on, couldn't you make it look like a MARTA bus?
Yeah.
What, how much
he's
would
on Marietta Street, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I also did.
These are things that like actual like New Yorkers and Los Angelinos see all the time in movies filmed there. You
right,
know?
Exactly.
Oh, there's
yeah.
my house. It's like, oh, that's not like the way it would be.
Yeah, and it's a small thing, and I think for most people, they're never going to notice or care. Right. But you know, the other joke that came to my head is the I don't know if you guys ever saw the ridiculous YouTube song, the bitch you ride the MARTA bus.
Oh yes,
which was done by a bunch of high school kids, I think, and it's. It's a couple years old, and it was very awful and funny at the time. And the first time that we see like zombies on a bus,
immediately,
Jen and I both just at same time just broke out into the chorus of "Bitch, You Ride the MARTA Bus."
This could be your like little YouTube clip that you could edit in your spare
exactly.
time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe we've. Beat this particular zombie as much as we can, you know, at this point. So maybe we should move on to some, like, video picks and things like that, you know, and kind of the last bit. And I'll start and actually stay sort of in the zombie theme, but not really, because I want to mention the movie I Walked with a Zombie, which is, I believe, directed by Jacques Tournier
produced by Val Lewton.
Yeah, which is one of Val Lewton produced all these really neat, smart horror films, I guess in the 40s primarily.
Yeah, for RKO.
Yeah,
he did
the
original Cat People.
Yeah, exactly. And he was very big on like not showing kind of what the terrifying thing was. So the shadows would be very artful and deep and cool, and there'd be all this kind of psychological tension and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I Walk with a Zombie takes place, I believe, in Haiti, maybe Jamaica. It's Haiti. Yeah, Haiti would make sense, you know. The plot is very much like the plot of Jane Eyre, only it has it takes place on this plantation, and there's a couple of zombified guys on it but they're not like rotting dead people like brains, you know, but you know, kind of more, they're almost more like somnambulists, like from the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, almost, you know. And there's a scene where she's like actually out on this plantation at night, and she sees this man who has been zombified and follows him, and it's the literally walking with a zombie part, and it's just dreamy, and the black and white is so rich, and it is. I kind of get chills just even thinking about it, you know. So it's like probably the best and smartest zombie movie that I can think of. Much as I love Shaun of the Dead, which is one of my favorite comedies, you know, but it's not really a zombie film like the kind of the current zombie film.
Right.
So you know,
I mean,
it's also it's quite short too, so it's really awesome.
all of that Val Lewton stuff for RKO is really beautiful. There's, you know, he did the original Cat People, which is great. He did a movie called The Seventh Victim, which I love, which is this weird sort of like this girl's sister has disappeared in New York, and she goes to find her, and it turns out that maybe the sister was or wasn't sort of a victim of this weird sort of satanic cult. And but again, much like I Walked with a Zombie, it's a very low-key sort of quiet thing. And, you know, one of the fun things about Val Lewton Pictures is that, and I think I Walk with the Zombie was one of these, is that he would be given titles and then basically have to have the film written around the title. And I'm positive that I Walked with the Zombie is one of those where the, you know, he was just like, okay, make this movie.
Yeah.
And so he was sort of like, all right. And he just had a wonderful little stable of great creators, you know, writers, cinematographers, directors that he worked with, and super budget pictures, you know, real B pictures in the classic sense of the word, where a lot of that stuff was shot on standing RKO sets. So, like, you know, you can see, like, things that would be in, like, an Orson Welles picture that also show up being reused in some of the Val Lewton stuff. And, yeah, those are really, really beautiful, awesome movies. Warner Brothers did a box set, the Val Lewton collection. They did it on Laserdisc years ago, which I had, and that was my first introduction to Lewton. It was like early to mid-90s was this Laserdisc set, and then they put that stuff out on DVD maybe 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And I think they're still in print, and they're all the DVDs are all like double feature DVDs, but they have some good commentaries, and there's a good documentary on him that I think TCM produced or co-produced. And yeah, so all of that stuff is really worth seeing and really cool. I would recommend, I don't know, I guess there are a couple of things. American Grindhouse, the documentary, I watched last night after watching The Walking Dead, streaming on Netflix. And it's just kind of an oral and visual history, obviously, of exploitation pictures in the U.S. and how that led to, you know, the 42nd Street movie theaters and you know, which became Grindhouse theaters. And it's a pretty good, you know, it's very superficial in a lot of ways, but it's got a lot of, it's got 80 years to cover, and does so in a good amount of detail. And it's narrated by Robert Forster, who's a fantastic actor and really works well as a narrator. It's got a lot of great talking head appearances from directors like John Landis and Joe Dante. And it's just a really, if you're even vaguely interested in that sort of kind of low budget horror exploitation thing, it's just a good overview. And there might be a few movies mentioned in it that you've never seen. Yeah. And there's some good outtakes. And I mean, Landis is always a great guy to listen to, because he's just jovial and jokey and doesn't really, he speaks very well and he's very knowledgeable, but he's not sort of like super arch or academic or pretentious or anything. So
yeah, I would on that, that made me think of the another documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, which is about the Australia's B-movie scene and kind of, I guess, the maybe 60s, 70s, and 80s primarily. And it goes through like kind of these like sex comedies and horror films and culminating and like car movies, basically.
Right.
Sort of culminating with like Mad Max and the Road Warriors, kind of the height of them. Yeah, stunt rock. And Quentin Tarantino speaks in that and is, you know, it's hard to imagine him not liking a movie almost, because he seems like he can find something to get excited about almost any movie, you know. So it's very fun in that, wow, look at all these crazy movies, and I'm probably enjoying seeing these crazy clips of these movies more than the actual movies in a lot of cases.
Right.
But it's a very fun documentary too.
And actually, that reminds me really quick, the Plaza here in Atlanta next week, I believe, is showing the movie Rolling Thunder, which is a magnificent 70s revenge movie. Starring,
and which you've mentioned before on the show.
I think so. Starring William Devane and Tommy Lee Jones. And I just thought of it because Quentin Tarantino's kind of grindhousey releasing company in the 90s, he named Rolling Thunder after that film. So it's just a good time to remind people. And the movie's not on DVD or not on DVD in the States and never has been. So it's kind of difficult to see, but it's a really, really cool little picture. So it's at the Plaza. They're showing it a couple of nights. It's not just
I think it's
one
the
night.
Second and the fifth. I had an email that conversation with that.
Yeah, that
like
sounds
maybe
right.
9:30. You know?
Yeah. So if you're even vaguely interested in this sort of stuff and have, or especially if you haven't seen Rolling Thunder, put that on the calendar at the Plaza because it should be definitely worth a look.
I have something very different, but it's a film I saw a couple weeks ago, but I keep thinking back to it, and it's kind of appropriate since basketball season just started. It's called Winning Time, the Knicks versus Reggie Miller, and it's about the sort of rivalry between the New York Knicks and the Indiana Pacers in the mid-90s, and I'm not like a huge sports documentary guy, but this one is just very well made. It was directed by Dan Cloris, who did the film Crazy Love. And it's just a really it has a lot of personality to it, especially because of Reggie Miller. Reggie is just – you know, there are some basketball players who just – and or any sports players, you know, they perform really well on the field. But in terms of holding the attention of a camera, they're just sort of bland and don't have much personality. But Reggie Miller isn't one of them. He was known for his trash talk. And even one of my favorite moments in the documentary is they're talking with Patrick Ewing, who was on the Knicks, and he was, you know, this great prospect for them. And Patrick Ewing is known for kind of being a disappointment to the team, but also not for having much in the way of personality. But he has this moment where, you know, they're asking about Reggie Miller, and he's like, yeah. And he just pauses and goes, man, I hated Reggie. It's just fantastic. But there's just so many great moments because it's not just like one – it doesn't come down to just one series. It's like, okay, the Pacers, you know, they lost this series. But then the Knicks and the Pacers came together again the following year. And, you know, they met up again and, you know, it was different this time. And it was really interesting. But then there's this one game where Spike Lee is like a huge New York Knicks fan, has courtside seats, gets really into the game. And apparently he had this bet with Reggie Miller where I forget like what would happen if the Knicks won the game. But if the Pacers won the game, then Spike Lee would put Reggie's wife into his next movie or something. Mm-hmm. Something like that. But Spike Lee gets really into it. Mm-hmm. And somehow –
is he interviewed on the
– oh, he's interviewed and he talks about it and it's fantastic. But what happened in the game was is like the Pacers were really far behind. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Reggie Miller hits a hot streak. Mm. And instead of like trash talking the other players, of which they talked to, like, and he was fine trash talking the other players. But what he does is he just stares down Spike Lee. like every time he makes a shot, he just looks at Spike Lee. And everyone on TV can see this. Yeah. Everyone can see him looking directly at Spike Lee. And so the Knicks lose the game. And the following day, the papers are like, Spike Lee lost us the game. And it's amazing. And Spike Lee is like, I wasn't even on the team. I was just a fan. It was insane. And it's just a lot of fun stuff like that. It's really entertaining. It's part of ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary series where each film is done by a different documentary director. I think, you know, Peter Berg has done one.
Is that the same series that Spike Lee did the Kobe Bryant doc for?
Possibly.
Okay.
So, you know, I would highly recommend checking this one out. I've looked into the other ones. I haven't watched them, but looking at the reviews, they're all pretty high quality, interesting stuff. But I like this one because it's not necessarily focusing on – for instance, there is another 30 for 30 documentary that focuses on the Red Sox comeback to win the World Series. And it's like we all know that story. We all saw it. This one is sort of like – it sort of got forgotten. And I'm sure, you know, in the mid-90s – it was a great story, but then when you come back to it and you have like sort of a retrospective and you have these players who aren't in the game anymore, but they're sort of looking back on their history and, you know, what it was like being a part of that, you get a really interesting and fun story. So I would highly recommend checking out Winning Time.
Yeah. I tend to like sports documentaries more than I like actual sports. So that sounds pretty cool. Anyway, well, fun zombies, movies, and sports, fun things to talk about this week. We'll probably talk about actual new movies with our next podcast. So until then, I'm Kurt Holman, and I tweet at Kurt _ Holman. It still doesn't feel normal saying I tweet, you know. Maybe it's just me, you know.
I'm Matt Goldberg with Collider.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and since everybody else is doing it, I might as well tell you that my Twitter name is also Russ Fisher, all one word.
And thanks again to Alejandro Leal for putting up with listening to us, for going on at length and recording our podcast. And thank you for listening all the way through to the end.